of unfinished projects lying around gathering dust? My house is filled with old furniture that other people started to refinish and they never got around to, and they eventually got rid of, and so I took it on. One of the most challenging projects that I ever took on was a doctoral dissertation. I was told at the beginning of that process that finishing a doctoral dissertation, the program and the dissertation specifically, is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. And I don't know if that's exactly true, but I can tell you there was plenty of perspiration and there were many tears along the way. The PhD completion project estimates the tenure completion rate of PhD dissertations is 55 to 64% in STEM, 56% in the social sciences, and 49% in the humanities. That's the tenure completion rate. That's how hard it is and how easy it is to be sidetracked, to be distracted, to give up. Many who start with the goal of getting a PhD end up with a ABD, all but dissertation. All but dissertation. Someone said a seminar paper is a 5K fun run. A doctoral dissertation is an ultra marathon. I think they're probably right. My friends, this morning, I simply want to remind you of something I think you already know, but I want to remind you this morning that living the Christian life and serving God is not a fun run. It's not a 5K fun run. It is an ultra marathon. One Jade pastor put it this way. Originally, my life's goal was a huge silver banner with the words, "Win the world for Christ." Eventually, it became, "Win one or two people." Now it's, "Try not to lose too many." Now, that may be a little bit overly pessimistic, but what Nehemiah reminds us of today is that the journey, the path of serving God, is filled with obstacles, it's filled with opposition and distractions, and it's easy to be tempted to quit, to stop, not to finish. Now, I don't know what God's called you to, but I believe God has called every one of us, every one of his children, to a unique and special work. That's what this series is all about. It's living life on purpose. It's engaging your unique purpose in the mission of God. God has a unique purpose for you. He has a calling on your life. It's not just vocational ministry. All of us are called to that. I don't know what he's called you to, but I do know that calling is filled with challenges and opposition. And I want to encourage you today to overcome them. I want to learn from Nehemiah today how to deal with the distractions that would derail us. Well, many of us are familiar with Nehemiah. He served the king in the Persian palace following the Babylonian exile. He was a cupbearer to Artaxerxes I, and he had a very important role as cupbearer, a role that had tremendous responsibility and required trust and confidence. That was the role that he was given in the palace. And like Moses that we looked at last week, who was raised in the palace, Nehemiah is in the palace. And he had tremendous honor and even power in that position. And yet, like Moses, he walked away from that plush palace life to pick up the mantle of service and leadership in God's work and God's mission. And he left the palace and he went back to Jerusalem that had been decimated. The wall had been destroyed. He went back there to challenge the people to rise up and rebuild the wall. And a miracle occurred. They completed the project in 52 days. An accomplishment even the enemies of God had to acknowledge was divinely empowered. They knew God had to do this. There's no other way it could have been accomplished. When we look at Nehemiah's life, and his example, he teaches us many, many things about integrity, about faith, about confidence, about determination, about devotion, about vision. All these things he teaches us. This morning, I want to center in on three things that we learn from Nehemiah, specifically related to this sermon series on living on purpose. So these are the three things we're going to learn today. Number one, engaging your purpose in God's mission puts a target on your back. Two, distractions come in many shapes and sizes. And then three, devotion to God's mission diminishes distractions. That's what we're going to talk about today. So again, I want you to think and process what we go through today through the grid and the kind of the vision that God has given you, the service that he's called you to do, whatever it is, in the church or outside the church. So let's begin with the verse principle. Engaging your purpose in God's mission puts a target on your back. It puts a target on your back. One thing that's clear from Nehemiah's story is that life is a battle from beginning to end. Amen? It is a battle, especially for those who are serious about serving the Lord. Nehemiah had a target on the back, right on his back. From the moment he embraced that mantle, he embraced his purpose and God's mission. From that moment on, he had a big target on his back. And the enemies of Israel had it in for him. He was blasted with a barrage of opposition from Sanballat, who was the governor of Samaria to the north, Tobiah, ruler of the Ammonites to the east, and Geshem, leader of the Arabs to the south. It's coming from all directions. How many of you can relate to that? No, don't raise your hand. Right? It comes from all directions and all times, right? That's what happened to him. In fact, I don't know if you've ever felt like this, but I've often felt like my Christian life and experience and service for God is like three steps forward. I'm thinking, yeah, and then it's like, oh, two steps back. And then it's three steps forward, and then it's two back. Yeah, you ever feel like that? That's what serving God is like. And I believe that's exactly how Nehemiah felt. Once he received this call, went back to the city, began to assemble the workers, and the rebuilding of the wall began. It was three steps forward, two back, three forward, two back, as these waves of distractions and opposition came from all directions. In chapter 3 of Nehemiah, we have the initial launch of the project, and the wall goes forward, and the whole chapter recounts great progress. They get about halfway done. And then at the beginning of chapter 4, the first three verses, it's two steps back. And then verses 4 through 6, it's going forward. And then 7, 8, it's going back. In 4, 9, there's a forward step. In 4, 10 through 12, they're going back. And then in 4, 13 through 23, they're going forward again. And then in chapter 5, 1 through 6, it's two steps back. Chapter 5, 7 through 19, forward. 6, 1 through 14, back. And on it goes until the wall is completed. It's just like this back and forth. Wouldn't you think that this God we were singing about a few moments ago, there's no one like this God, that when you're on his side doing his work, wouldn't you think it'd be a little easier? I mean, we have this idea in our minds that if we're in the will of God, doing the will of God and the power of God, that life is going to go pretty smoothly, that it will be pretty rosy. But that's not the picture we have in the Bible. God himself has an enemy, and we have an adversary. And it's not just the enemy out there, it's the enemy in here, it's me. Often the two steps back is not because of the devil, it's because of Bob. Because of my own flesh. It's the world, the system around us. We have all this opposition, things distracting us. We feel called. We're going in a direction, and we launch out, and often at the beginning, we're all full of joy and excitement, and then we hit the wall. We're like, God, what? Then we have to regroup, kind of take a step back and refocus and begin again, and that's how it works. Life on purpose is the best life because it's a life of fulfillment and meaning and significance for eternity, and yet it's not easy. There's a target on our back. Neil Anderson describes this vision, this idea of following God, going toward Jesus, serving him. Let me read this description and try to imagine in your mind what he's talking about. Perhaps it won't take much imagination. He writes, imagine that you're standing at one end of a long, narrow street lined on both sides with two-story apartments. At the other end of the street stands Jesus Christ, and your Christian life is the process of walking down that long street with your eyes on the author and finisher of your faith. That's the Christian life, is keeping your eyes on him, following him, serving him as you move toward him. He continues, there's absolutely nothing in the street that can keep you from walking toward Jesus by faith and the power of the Spirit. So when you receive Christ, fix your eyes on him and start walking, start serving. But since this world is still under the dominion of Satan, the apartments on either side are inhabited by beings who are committed to keeping you from reaching your goal. They have no power or authority to block your path or even slow your step. So they hang out of the windows and they call to you, hoping to turn your attention away from your goal and disrupt your progress. Some will tempt you saying, hey, look over here. I've got something you really want. It tastes good. It feels good. It's a lot more fun than that boring walk you're on that street. Come on and take a look. Life is filled with distractions because once you fix your eyes on Jesus, there's a target on your back and the enemy does not want you to complete that race. That's what happened to Nehemiah. As we'll see in a moment, the opposition came in many different forms, but when they realized they couldn't, through overt attempts and efforts, stop him, they tried something different. And they did exactly what Neil Anderson described. In chapter 6, they said, come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. Oh, let's be buddies. Come on, let's meet halfway. Let's compromise. And they're diverting him, distracting him. And it was all a ruse. It was a scheme to take him away from the work and to take him out, to stop him from completing the project that God had called him to complete. My friends, God has a target on our back. Satan has a target on our back once we begin to follow God. You probably have seen it. It's still one of my favorite Far Side comic strip by Gary Larson. You know, you got these deer standing in the woods, and the one deer has this bullseye on him, and the other says, bummer of a birthmark, Hal. And when you become a child of God, you have a birthmark on your back. It's the birthmark of child of God, and the enemy hates you, wants to stop you, wants to divert your attention. When you say, yes, I want to live on purpose, and you get serious, then the heat is turned up. It's not a reason not to do it. It's all the more reason to redouble your efforts and deal with him so that you can complete the work that God has called you to. So what kind of schemes and arrows and distractions does the enemy use? When we begin following Jesus, serving him, what does he use to attack us? Well, he's not only relentless, he's also very creative. And there are many different schemes that he uses. In the New Testament, Paul urged the Ephesian Christians, put on the full armor of God so that you can stand against the devil's schemes. Schemes are planned, subtle, systemized efforts to deceive and distract, to oppose, to distract. And they come from many different directions and take many different forms, as we've already said. So let's just do a quick overview of what happened to Nehemiah. Let me overview. And hopefully, as we talk about these things, you'll be able to identify some of the attacks, some of the distractions and disruptions that have come in your life. First category that I would identify in the distractions, what I would call direct opposition. There was direct opposition to the project. Think resistance, overt, brazen, bold resistance. Think Trump resistance, okay? You got that in your mind? Think Antifa. That's what it is. They're going to stop him at all costs. And it began with verbal opposition, angry words, ridicule, mockery, insults. In chapter 2:19, it says, when they heard about it, that is, when they heard the wall was going to be rebuilt, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this they're doing? Are they rebelling against the king? In chapter 4, once the work had already begun, they furthered these efforts. What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring these stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are? What they are building, if even a fox climbed on it, he would break down the wall of stones. They're mocking them. Do you ever have people verbally attack you? If you stand up for Jesus, if you talk about Jesus, it's like, you know, knock a mole, hit a mole, or whatever it is. You know, you stand up for him, somebody's going to knock you. They're going to hit you. And I remember it's happened to me when I was younger, especially if you say you're called to some kind of ministry. I've been called everything from deacon to preacher to you name it. And Teresa, when she was in high school, followed the Lord, tried to live for him. They called her the Bible. I don't think it was meant as a compliment. And you know what I'm talking about. And so think about what's happening when those kinds of things are used and said. The enemy is using people to try to discourage you, to try to slow you down. You're trying to run this race and follow Jesus and serve him. And yet when those things come, it's like it causes you to pull back. You want to pull back a little bit. You want to be quiet. You don't want to be quite so vocal about your faith and about who God is. Another form of verbal opposition came through threats of violence. They upped the ante a little bit. It wasn't just mockery. Now they're threatening them. In chapter 4, it says, before they know it or see us, we will be right there among them and we'll kill them and put an end to the work. Now, that's real nice. You know, the workers are there serving God, and they're thinking, man, they're going to kill us. And so at one point, they had to post guards. And so they have a trowel in one hand and a spear in the other. My friends, that's what this life is like when you're serving God. It is a battle. And the enemy wants to take you out. Well, there was another form of opposition, another category that I would identify. It's essentially indirect opposition. It wasn't quite so brazen and blatant. It was much more indirect. And it actually involved some things in their own lives and in their own community. I don't know if you've had this experience or not, but some of the most discouraging things in my life have not necessarily been from the devil or from myself. It's been even in the church, right? I mean, sometimes things that happen in a church are discouraging and disheartening. And sometimes we're wounded like David was. And he said, if it was my enemy that was doing this to me, I could deal with it. But it's you, the one I went to worship with. It's you. And sometimes that's what hurts us the most is we're trying to serve. And that's what happened to Nehemiah and the wall builders. Part of it came through discouragement and negativity. In chapter 4:10, it says, meanwhile, the people of Judah said, so read that. Now, the people of Judah, these are their brothers and sisters. The strength of the laborers is giving out, and there's so much rubble, we cannot rebuild the wall. You've heard that, right? Oh, we can't do it. Why are we doing this? What's the use? It's never going to work. That's what was happening. And they became overwhelmed when they looked at all the rubble and all the work that needed to be done. And Nehemiah had to step back and say, no, wait a minute, time out. Don't look there. Look at the Lord and how great he is. Keep your eyes on him. It was very difficult for them not to be pulled down, distracted, and taken out of the work. Chapter 4, verse 12, it says, then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they will attack us. Again, this is their own countrymen. They're saying, Nehemiah, don't you know they've said it over and over? Doesn't matter where we turn, they're going to come. They're going to get us. What are we doing this for? They're going to attack us. And he's got to carry this. You have to deal with it. So it's not enough to deal with the enemy out there. It's the enemy right here among us in terms of being negative. And the goal, of course, as with terrorism, was to instill fear. In chapter 6, verse 9, it says, they were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. That was their tactic. He said, their hands will get too weak for the work. It will not be completed because we're frightening them. And so, again, Nehemiah had to say, don't be afraid of them. Look to God. So difficult, so hard to overcome some of these distractions. But there was another distraction that came. And this might have been more than two steps back. This is something that happened inside of their hearts. And I want you to look, if you haven't turned, turn to Nehemiah chapter 5. I want to read a few verses and describe for you what was happening so you understand what's happening. Nehemiah has come back. He's assembled the Jews. They're now building the wall, but there's something else going on. There's a famine occurring, and there are people among them who are taking advantage of the poor. They're banking on the fact that once the wall is rebuilt, land prices are going to go up, and they're scheming and planning to line their own pockets through the circumstances. It says in chapter 5, verse 1, now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. Some were saying, we and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain. Others were saying, we're mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, our homes to get grain during the famine. And still others are saying, we've had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Although we are of the same flesh, listen, although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we're powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. Nehemiah said, when I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind and then accused the nobles and officials. I told them, you're exacting usury from your own countrymen. So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, as far as possible, we have bought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you're selling your brothers only for them to be sold back to us. They kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. So you get what's happening, right? I mean, they're at work. They're on a project. They're on a mission. They're building the wall, but they have to say, time out. Okay, time out. I got to call a meeting. We got to have a meeting to deal with something different, something else. And it was a selfish motivation. It was diverted attention. Rather than being on mission, these people were on a mission for personal selfish gain. And my friends, I think one of the biggest tactics that the enemy uses is to draw us into living for this life and laying up treasures here on earth instead of treasure in heaven. It's so easy to be drawn into that because we live in a culture, we are immersed, submerged, completely surrounded with this materialistic mindset where everything from birth to the grave is all about getting a good job, good education, all of this. And we could think that's what life is for instead of it's for living for the kingdom, to advance the kingdom. And that's one of the greatest distractions to life on purpose for us today in our culture. So these distractions come in many shapes and sizes. So how do we overcome them so that we stay on purpose? Well, we learn, thirdly, from Nehemiah, devotion to God's mission diminishes distractions. It doesn't remove them, but it diminishes them. Nehemiah called the meeting, kind of reamed out the officials for exacting usury from their countrymen, and this is what he said later in that same gathering. Their assistants also lorded it over the people, but out of reverence for God, I did not act like that, he said. Instead, I devoted myself to the work on the wall. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire land. You see, we had a single focus. We knew our purpose was there for this work, the wall. And so we didn't even buy land. And devotion to that work diminished those distractions. It wasn't a distraction for them. And as we saw already in chapter 6, when they called Nehemiah, they said, "Hey, come on, meet us halfway." This was his response. "I'm carrying on a great project and I cannot go down. Why should I stop work while I leave it and go down to you?" 4 times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. I just love that. It's like, "No, I'm not coming." I like what it says in the contemporary English version. "My work is too important to stop now and go there." He's got this vision, this calling, this purpose. It's big. He said, "I can't stop." He knew even beyond the deception that was underlying their request. He knew that. But beyond that, he said, "It's too important to stop and go meet with you." So here's kind of the bottom line. This is where it really comes down to where we all live. Why, this is the question, why did Nehemiah have such a devotion to that work? How was it he could stay focused and not be caught up in these things, caught up in the purchase of land, caught up in all these other things? How was that? Well, we have to go back to chapter 1 to find out. So turn back to chapter 1. In 444 B.C., Nehemiah was serving in the summer palace of Susa when a conversation with his brother changed everything in his life. In chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, 'Those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire.'" Now, my friends, you have to understand that this is not new news. Nehemiah knew most of this, because this had occurred 140 years prior. But somehow, in this moment, when he heard this graphic description of the pain and the suffering of his people back in Jerusalem, somehow God came into his heart and broke his heart. You see it in the next verse, verse 4. "When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven." The reason Nehemiah was so devoted to this mission, this work, is because the vision for it, the call, came through God's breaking his heart with the needs of the people there. What makes you weep? What makes you weep or just pound the table? This is just not right. Is there anything that makes you weep when you look around and see the needs of people? Is it homelessness? Human trafficking? The addiction crisis that is affecting everyone? Abortion? When you look around, is there anything that grips your heart and makes you weep and say, "This has got to change"? What about lost people? The Bible says Jesus came to seek and save the lost. And we say lost people matter to God. They matter to us. He wants them found. Do they really matter? I confess to you that it's been a long time since I have shed tears over the lost. So you say, well, Bob, I don't have anything that grips my heart. I'm not burdened in that way, so therefore I must not have a call from God. No, I would say to you, if you don't have a burden, if you don't have something in your heart that's burning, then you need to get on your knees until it comes. And say, God, would you open my eyes to see what you see, what you are doing, so that you'll break my heart with the things that break your heart, so that I will be so devoted to that mission that nothing will divert my attention, nothing will distract me, nothing will stop me. And as a church, we need to come to that place where we as a church say, this is the main thing that we're here for, and we have to fight to keep the main thing the main thing. You see, that's the way to overcome distractions. Otherwise, if it's just one among many options for us to consider doing, it'll be so easy to be pulled off track. So I'm asking you to join me in seeking God and saying, God, would you do something in me? Maybe you can think back years ago, maybe decades ago in your Christian life when you had this passion and this flame, and now it's kind of grown cold and it's just an ember. Are you willing to say, God, would you fan that again and bring it back to flame? God, I don't want to just flame out for you. I want to burn out to the end. Life on purpose, engaging your purpose in God's mission. It's going to bring distractions, and the only way you're going to overcome, the only way you're going to finish well, is you're fully devoted to that mission because God has born it in your heart. I read about a missionary in China, very gifted missionary. His skills were so exceptional that an American company tried to hire him, and they offered him an attractive salary and attractive position in the company. And he explained to him, say, I'm a missionary. God called me here to China to do work. I can't leave to do that. He thought that would be the end of it. And they came back to him and they said a second time, we want you to come. And they gave him a more attractive offer. They bumped up the salary. They enlarged the opportunity, made it more appealing. And he said again, I can't leave here to take that job. I'm here for a work. Well, they came back a third time. And they doubled the previous offer. And he was overwhelmed. He said, I don't think you understand. He said, it's not your salary that's too little. It's the job that's too small. And that's the mindset we need to have, my friends. When we think about God's mission and what he is doing, it's so big. And he's called you and me into that. We need to live on purpose with that vision so that we'll overcome all the distractions and we'll finish the work he's called us to. Amen? Amen. I want you to take a moment right now and pray. We're going to close the service in a moment. We have a few things we need to say, but I want you to respond to this today. And maybe it's time right now just to pray and say, God, would you stir something new in my heart? Give me a new vision, new burden. Would you break my heart with the things that break yours? Show me what you want me to do. Father, we are so overwhelmed and amazed at the fact that you not only love us and call us your own, but that you call us into your work. You invite us to come and have a place on the team. You're at work in people's lives all around us. And you invite us to come and be a part of that, to use the gifts and skills, the abilities that you've put within us. What an awesome privilege that is. God, would you continue to just kindle within us a flame, a burden that will drive us out into that work with passion and fervor that will propel us forward through the distractions and opposition. Thank you for our church family. Thank you that we can serve together, that we can be your representatives here in this community. God, help us to keep the main thing, to overcome the many temptations to be distracted to other lesser things.